Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I'm standing up for the principle of democracy. I'm standing up for moderation. And I'm standing up for hope for all the people in Pakistan who today are poor and miserable and really quite desperate.
The death of a leader dims hopes for democracy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Amy Scott, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the 27th of December. Good to have you with us. We began with the words of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto from a recent CNN interview. Her assassination today during a campaign rally sparked violence across Pakistan. At least 29 others have died in the attack and in the riots that have followed. Now there's some question whether the parliamentary election scheduled for January 8th will go ahead as scheduled. Bhutto was a leading candidate for prime minister. For many inside and outside the country, she offered hope for a more democratic Pakistan and a more open economy. Professor Shumit Ganguly joins us now from Indiana University, where he teaches political science. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Pakistan is in turmoil right now. What do you think the economic impact of this assassination could be?
I think the economic impact of this assassination could be considerable, especially if widespread demonstrations ensue. And I think demonstrations are entirely likely because I think there is a wellspring of anger right now among significant segments of the Pakistani populace, particularly amongst members of the Pakistan People's Party, Benazir Bhutto's party, against General Musharraf's regime.
Karachi is the financial capital of Pakistan and of course, Bhutto's base of popularity. Do you expect commerce to shut down there?
It's entirely likely that commerce could be shut down because imagine if widespread demonstrations ensue, one of the first things that the military will do is impose a curfew. Once you impose a curfew, people cannot go out, shops cannot open, normal economic transactions cannot take place, it's impossible for people to go to work. And then if the principal port city comes to a standstill, docks will not work, goods that are coming into the country cannot be unloaded, things that were supposed to be shipped out cannot go out. So I think there is a real danger of a significant economic disruption. And the military will have to balance the considerations of security and public order with maintaining certain essential sort of commercial activities because they are acutely cognizant that unless they can keep the economic engine of the country humming at some level, their slender legitimacy is going to evaporate.
So I understand there's been a bit of an economic boom in Pakistan recently that's attracting foreign investors. How do you think Bhutto's death will affect investment in the country?
I think this is going to give investors significant pause. Bear in mind that a lot of the investment had been coming in from Pakistani expatriates who were parking their money in Pakistan because they felt that General Musharraf had at least restored some degree of order, if not law, in Pakistan. But now, given the spate of violence that is likely to sweep across the country, most investors, even those who have emotional ties to Pakistan, are going to be somewhat circumspect.
Now, of course, there's the question of foreign aid. President Bush here in the States just signed a bill to provide $300 million in military aid to Pakistan, but it's contingent on some democratic reforms. Do you think this money will go through now that Bhutto has been killed?
I think Congress, which is in a somewhat more assertive mood, is probably going to try and withhold the disbursement of these funds, particularly since the bulk of it is really earmarked for the Pakistani military. Given the fact that the elections that were scheduled for the 8th of January 2008 are now up in the air, I think the possibility of substantial amounts of foreign aid flowing into Pakistan are limited. Because there's no point pouring in money into a country where institutions are practically at a standstill.
All right. Professor Shumit Ganguly teaches political science at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Turning now to the U.S. economy, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has handed businesses a major victory. The commission ruled yesterday that companies can cut their retirees' health care benefits once they turn 65. That's, of course, when Medicare kicks in. The ruling means employers can shift the burden of insuring retirees to the federal government. So with all that extra savings, employers will probably start spending more money on younger workers, right? Don't count on it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Many employees dream of retiring with a Cadillac healthcare plan. So much for sweet dreams. Under the EEOC's new rule, your employer can drop you when you turn 65. That Cadillac plan morphs into the standard Chevy, Medicare. But your sacrifice could help keep younger workers on the retirement road. James Klein is president of the American Benefits Council, which lobbies for large employers. He says any money saved by cutting coverage will be used to pay benefits for early retirees, teachers, for example.
For many teachers, the ability for them to retire before age 65 was dependent upon their ability to continue getting health care coverage from their former employers, school district.
In fact, two teachers' unions support the new rule. But Anna Berger of the Service Employees International Union says employers could keep any savings from Medicare for themselves.
It's hard to imagine how you can expect them voluntarily to take those savings and share them with younger workers unless there's some mechanism to require it.
Analyst Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution says this ruling follows a trend of more government-funded health care. That's something employers want because it allows them to focus on business, not health insurance.
Most employers, I think, are primarily interested in matters other than administering health care benefits. They want to do other things, make those commodities, sell those goods.
Already, some business groups are saying without Medicare, they couldn't afford to insure any of their retired workers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If pinching pennies is one of your New Year's resolutions, take note. Coupons are going digital. Next week, Velasis Communications plans to launch a website it hopes will reinvent the lowly paper coupon for the internet age. Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
When it seems like just about everything has made the jump into cyberspace, it may come as a surprise that coupons have had a tough time shedding their scissor and paper roots. Over the last year, the small number of existing online coupon sites like Cool Savings and Valpak.com have struggled to catch on. That's where Velasis Communications, which represents clients like Eggo Waffles and Dr. Pepper, hopes to break new ground. Chief Marketing Officer Susie Brown says their new website, redplum.com, is about a lot more than just coupons.
This is really more of a lifestyle site. This is a way that people can find value and use that value to make their lives better. And so I think coming late to the game, if that's the way you want to put it, is not necessarily a bad thing.
Brown says features like product reviews, recipes, and the ability to match coupons to your shopping list make the site unique. But retail analyst Patty Freeman Evans with Jupiter Research says there's another reason companies like Velasis are going digital, to capture that coveted 18 to 24-year-old consumer.
They're not as interested in direct mail. They're not so interested in email marketing in order to make purchase decisions. And so retailers need to find new ways to appeal to these customers.
The traditional shotgun approach, sending millions of paper coupons by mail, has grown less effective over the years. Currently, the response rate is only about 0.1%. Evan says customizing coupons to individual users, especially younger ones, may be the only hope for boosting those numbers. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Investors responded to a slew of bad news. We'll have details when we do the numbers. There's another sign today that the credit crunch has yet to loosen its grip on deal-making. The Wall Street Journal reports that media company Freedom Communications is postponing a plan to buy out two minority stakeholders. It's having trouble getting financing. Credit was, of course, the big story on Wall Street this year. And with 2008 just a few days away, we're taking a look back. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon is here with us. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Amy.
So, Bob, take us back about 6 months ago before the term credit crunch passed any of our lips. What exactly set this whole thing off?
Well, you know, it's been a paradox of a year, Amy. Remember, it was back on July 19th that we saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average close above the 14,000 mark for the first time in its history. And it's tempting to say that it was all downhill from there, but actually there were some pretty wild lurches until the Dow finally sank back down below the 13,000 mark by the middle of August. Well, what caused things to deteriorate so suddenly was lenders and investors started noticing that some big banks were owning up to some pretty sizable holdings of securities that were backed by these subprime mortgages. They were loaded down with really a confusing array of very complicated investment packages that were tied to home loans that went to borrowers with poor credit. So the true value of all that paper became really suspect. In fact, some banks started telling investors that they had no idea how to figure out exactly what that paper was really worth. And these questionable holdings were suddenly being exposed in the portfolios of banks and investment funds around the world.
Why was it so sudden? I mean, shouldn't we have seen this coming?
Exactly the question that a lot of people have been asking. Why did a lot of financial analysts seem to miss this one? Even though that there were plenty of signs going back to the fall of last year, where there was first word of the sharp rise in home foreclosures. Then this past spring, what was then the country's second biggest subprime lender, New Century Financial, announced that it had stopped accepting loan applications because it couldn't get access to funding from some of its financial backers. And then the alarm bells really started going off when Countrywide Financial, the nation's biggest mortgage lender, just barely avoided bankruptcy back in August. The experts do tell us that these mortgages got rebundled and sold in so many different kinds of investment products that even the analysts had trouble figuring out just how risky they really were.
So where do things stand now?
The numbers are staggering, Amy. Around the world, major banks and financial firms have announced more than $36 billion in write-downs, which is a fancy way of saying that's what they lost.
Bob, I know a lot of people on Wall Street are really ready for this year to be over. But, I mean, do we have any reason to believe 2008 is going to be any better?
Well, we've seen some rays of hope in some parts of the credit market, but frankly, it's still looking pretty grim. You've got a lot of this bad debt that's still cropping up on the balance sheets of banks around the world. The accounting years of a lot of these banks match the calendar years, so right about now we could be seeing them forced to reveal even more bad surprises. And central banks around the world are still injecting money supply and staying alert to maintain the flow of credit to those who need it, but it's still very hard for a lot of people to get loans.
Well, you mentioned the central banks. We've seen the Federal Reserve respond by lowering interest rates, making it easier for banks to borrow money. The Treasury Department's got its own plan to stave off foreclosure for millions of subprime borrowers. What's it going to take to really turn things around?
A lot of the experts that we talk to these days say the first order of business is restoring confidence in the debt market. And one of the biggest problems is that investors and lenders have been really skeptical of buying into anything that's tied to mortgages, even those kinds that were once considered safe. So they want to see reforms in the way that those loans are written and a lot more transparency into just how reliable those investments are going to be.
All right. Marketplace's Bob Moon, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Amy. We hope it's a Happy New Year.
But before the new year hits, we'll have our Shanghai Bureau Chief Scott Tong with us. Scott joins us tomorrow to talk about another of 2007's big market catalysts, the manufacturing prowess of China. It's been 15 years since Stella Liebeck spilled a cup of McDonald's coffee in the driver's seat of her Ford Probe. Liebeck sued McDonald's for gross negligence. She suffered serious burns. A jury awarded Liebeck $2.9 million, though a judge ultimately cut that number to $640,000. The case inspired an episode of Seinfeld and a Weird Al Yankovic song. It also inspired commentator Carl Meyer.
One minute I'm enjoying the simplest of quick lunch pleasures. The next I'm hurtling down a path toward oblivion, a twig-like object wedged between my teeth. The culprit was a can of chunk-white albacore. I plunged my hand into the mess and clamped on the menacing stick. Pulling back, I experienced the same rush cardiologists must feel when the paddles bring a heartbeat back to life. I'm rich! The tuna bone glistened. My eyes darted to the can. Yes, I'd hooked into one of the big three. Now, instead of my life ending in premature asphyxiation, I'm suddenly contemplating ascension to the ruling class. Shaking, I washed the bone. I contacted the tuna company's website, stating facts. I have the bone. I have the can in a photo with a dated newspaper. I didn't mention lawsuit or involuntary manslaughter. We're all professionals. This could be handled neatly. I'd await their generous offer. I started pricing houses and hybrid cars. The letter arrived a week later. Standard mail. A bone the size you reported is not typical of our efforts to produce the highest quality canned tuna on the market. A settlement of sorts was enclosed. 4 free cans of albacore, with hopes that this would restore my consumer confidence. They requested the bone back and included 2 coupons for 25 cents off. Big Tuna, showing me the love. So this was customer care? Double coupons? My loyal silence secured for the price of stinking mackerel? Well, not so fast, Chunk Light. Even a fish knows fishy when he smells it. No deal, bottom feeder. Try starting with roses next time. Maybe a little sushi. For now, I'm securing your little tuna terra bone in a tiny evidence bag. Have your people get in touch with mine. We'll talk turkey, brand loyalty, hybrid cars.
Carl Meyer lives in Greenfield, Massachusetts. His book, Wild Animals of North America, won a 2008 Teacher's Choice Award for children's books. Send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click Contact. Coming up, investing can be beautiful.
Well, when I look at the stock charts, I often see them as reflections of nature, like a Ansel Adams photo.
But first, let's do the numbers. News of rising unemployment and falling durable goods orders gave Wall Street a drubbing today. The Dow Jones flopped 192 points, or 1.4%, to close at 13,359. The Nasdaq drifted down 1.75%, or 47 points, to end at 2676. The S&P 500 shed 1.4%, or 21 points, to finish the day at 1476. That bad durable goods news put the brakes on General Motors. The carmaker ended the day down nearly 1.75%. GM wasn't the only one getting a bumpy ride. Boeing jolted down 1.25%. Citigroup slipped nearly 3% after an analyst said the bank will cut its dividend. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 4.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home sales for November. On December 28, 1895, folks ponied up admission for the world's first commercial movie screening in Paris. The Lumiere brothers showed a series of shorts depicting everyday French life. And it's No Interruptions Day. Turn off phones and minimize distractions to focus on the year ahead. It's right around the corner. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Commercial surrogacy, or what's been called wombs for rent, is growing in India. Most of those seeking babies are wannabe parents from the United States, Taiwan, and Britain. They're willing to pay fees it might take these surrogate mothers 15 years to earn in traditional jobs. Surrogacy is legal in India, but it raises a controversial economic question. Is it exploitation or an opportunity? Sunita Thakur reports from Anand, India.
27-year-old Nandini Patel is 6 months pregnant. Her two children and her husband come to visit her at this clinic for surrogate mothers. She could go home, but would have to bear the taunts from her community that disapproves of surrogacy.
I've done this for my kids and because I have one dream, a house. We're living in a rented place. From the money I earn as a surrogate mother, I can buy a house. It's not possible for my husband to earn more as he's not educated and only earns $50 a month, so nothing's saved.
These surrogate mothers are paid $6,000 to $10,000, a fraction of what it costs in the United States. The Akanksha Infertility Clinic in Anand may have been the first official clinic to start paid surrogacy, but others are fast following its example. Julie, who doesn't want her last name mentioned, is a slim, attractive woman in her mid-30s. She's tried 5 times to have her own baby before coming in desperation to Anand rather than looking for a surrogate in the States.
The legal issues in the United States are complicated, having to do with that the surrogate mother still has legal rights to that child until they sign over their parental rights at the time of delivery. Of course, and there's the factor for cost for some couples in the United States. Surrogacy can reach up to $80,000.
Not only is surrogacy cheaper with less bureaucratic tapir, but most surrogate mothers stay either in the clinic or one of the supervised homes, making it easier to monitor diet and health. This kind of control just wouldn't be possible in the States, says Julie.
You have no idea if your surrogate mother is smoking, drinking alcohol, doing drugs. You don't know what she's doing. You have a third-party agency as a mediator between the two of you, but there's no one policing her in the sense that you don't know what's going on.
India, with English-speaking doctors and nurses and an advanced medical system, already attracts thousands of patients from abroad. In vitro fertilization, paid egg donation, and surrogacy are yet more in a fast-growing medical business. Dr. Patel winces when she hears surrogacy described as a business.
If you say it's a business of emotions, I would say yes, it's not business of economics and finances. There are a lot of emotions involved in this. And if a female is just doing this for business, I think this is not the right thing to do.
Critics say this is exploitation of poor women with few choices. But Priyanka Sharma, who's considering becoming a surrogate a second time, believes it's just survival in an unequal world.
Yes, I might do this again, because after all, there's nothing wrong in this. We give them a baby and they give us much-needed money. It's good for them and for us.
It's still an unregulated market, but India has drafted guidelines for something that is illegal in many countries around the world. It gives women the right to receive a fee. In Anand, this is Sunita Thakur for Marketplace.
A lot of stock traders, when they lose money, might have a drink or hit the gym. Tom Moran paints, and his trades are the inspiration. Moran looks at a stock chart and sees poetry in those peaks and valleys. I went to his studio in Queens, New York recently.
Why stock charts? What about these made you want to paint them?
Well, when I look at the stock charts, I often see them as reflections of nature, like a Ansel Adams photo. And I never know when one of them's going to pop out as a painting.
So when you say you look at it as an Ansel Adams photo, this is a good example. This looks like something that could be from Yosemite Valley.
Yeah.
What is it that you see there?
That's what I pictured also, just with that sudden price peak. It looks like a cliff. And this chart is a one day from the open of the market to the close. And I just find it fascinating, all that can happen in a day from minute to minute.
Well, it's a beautiful way of thinking of stocks. I suppose that could help when you're not having a good day on the trading floor or at your terminal.
Yeah, and actually a lot of the paintings serve as reminders of past trades, and a lot of them were bad days. And I think it's a great thing to do because it reminds me of my mistakes and I don't forget them.
It looks very pretty, but it's dark. Did you choose the black and the gray tones to reflect the mood that day?
I think so. The color is the most subjective part about the whole process, and I think that's part of why I picked those colors. This one was based on a price drop, a news that came out overnight, so the stock dropped dramatically and caused this form right here.
But I keep coming back to the fact that that is your money going up and down,
yeah.
And how can you sort of have that removed from it?
I think it's in my character, and as if you look at the chart, you also see a lot of when one's going down, another one's going up. So really, my main concern is the whole portfolio. As long as my portfolio value is going up, I'm happy.
So do you think that trading enables your art, or is it the other way around, or a little of both?
I think it's both at this point. Like I said, I've had difficulty stopping either or, so to focus on the other one more. I feel like it's just become part of my routine to do both.
So I was going to ask you, you sort of have a built-in audience with the Wall Street type. Who are your customers? Who's buying these?
Many of the recent collectors have been traders, I would say, about half of them. And their response has been great. I was amazed because at first I thought they might not like them. But actually, they've said things to me like the paintings gave what they do meaning.
You can see pictures of some of Tom Moran's paintings at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, here's a story of unlikely bedfellows. The United Nations and Marvel Comics have teamed up to create a comic book. The cartoon will be set in a war-torn, fictional country in which UN workers join forces with superheroes to stop conflict and rid the world of disease. Once completed, 1 million U.S. school children are set to receive the comic for free. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 192 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ dipped 47 points, 1.75%. And the S&P 500 lost 21 points, 1.4%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, the game Dungeons & Dragons heads to the web. Fans hope it'll capture some hearts along the way.
I think there's definitely sort of a stigma behind D&D for a lot of people and for role-playing games in general. If some of that went away, that'd be better.
I'm Amy Scott. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.